most of them are J-poles and half-wave NZs with a tuning stub, N2YJC.
Oh, precisely, that's what I have. It's a marine antenna attached to a boat. I have a marine VHF, which I use. I'm just wondering if I could use the use that antenna for 2 meters.
Well, let me find out a little bit more, Bill. Do you intend to use it on both marine 158 megs as well as 2 meters, in which case you're not likely to go in there and make a mechanical change to the antenna? Or are you asking us, is there a way that you can electronically make it work on both frequencies sequentially? And once again, tell me how many feet long it is, Bill. KC2SYL, K2LIW.
It's the standard Shakespeare Marine VHF antenna. I believe it's about 6 or 8 feet in length. I haven't measured it. I have it on my boat. And what I would do is I would disconnect it from the Marine VHF, which has a maximum power of 25 watts, and one I have also goes to 5 watts. And I would just disconnect the antenna, the connector, and then connect it to the either to the Yaesu 817 or my handy talkie here and just use it. I was just wondering if I could use that antenna without destroying the rigs. Back to you.
In the receive mode, the answer is absolutely yes, because receivers are amazingly forgiving. But when it comes to transmitting, because there are very, very few antenna tuners you and I can buy, and I've seen very, very few designs of antenna tuners, use an antenna tuner on a 158 megacycle marine antenna. Can you make it have a reasonable standing wave ratio on 146 megacycles? Absolutely. But if you take this 6 foot long antenna, which tells me it is a full wavelength long, half wave on that frequency is probably 35 inches. So you've got a full wavelength antenna. It's a two element collinear if you're accurate on the vertical length. You're going to get a somewhat complicated antenna pattern, even if you do put some kind of a tuning arrangement at the bottom. Without a doubt, you can make a little black box that has some kind of a tuning device in it and use it at the antenna itself or at the input end of the transmission line, and you can force that antenna to be resonant at, say, 146 megacycles if that's what you want to do. With the right kind of a tuning device, stub tuner, coax or resonator, whatever, there's all kinds of ways you can do it. I do recommend you do that. If you try to directly transmit into that antenna at 146 megs, I think there's a good possibility that your rig is going to see a 15-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now you're pushing your luck. You're not going to have very much power output, you're not going to be heard very far, and your rig's going to be unhappy. So some form of electrical or mechanical antenna tuning somewhere in the system, I think, is going to be required before you can use it on 146 meg. AC2SYL, K2LIW.
I appreciate that. I think the solution is just bring the handy talkie. I'll bring it with the antenna it comes with, and then just leave the marine VHF connected as it is. One other question about antennas. I'm anticipating taking a trip to the south within the next week or so, and I want to bring my handy talkie with me and use it in the car. I don't have the ability to put a mag mount on a car. Can I rig something up where I have like a suction cup mount to the window and put the correct antenna and use that as a transmission from my Kenwood to handy talkie? Back to that.
If you could put a suction cup on the window, I'm not sure if you're doing it on the outside of the window or inside the window on the car, what's stopping you from putting a mag mount on the roof of that car, Bill? Go ahead.
Now, I'll be going down as a driver. It's not my automobile. So putting something on the outside is not available to me right now, but I do have the suction mount device, which I got for my scanning days, which I think I can use. Back to you.
That suction device, will the antenna be inside the car or outside the car?
Inside the car, what I anticipate is next to the passenger side window, mounted, clear vision to the outside on the window itself.
In other words, the antenna will have its base suction cup on from the window, and the antenna will be projecting into the car where the passenger would be sitting. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, the cable on the suction cup device is long enough where I could actually connect it to a rear window, the rear passenger window, so it wouldn't be right next to it.
And 1IFY would have a better idea. Yeah, who's got a better idea? Give us your call letters and name and go ahead with your better idea.
Kilo Bravo 1 India Fox Yankee. They make a mount. What you do is you open up your window, it fits over your window, and you close it. You take your rubber ducky, you screw your rubber ducky onto it, it's got a little wire on it, and you screw it into your HT.
Yeah, having the antenna inside the car cuts down the performance of the antenna by lots of dBs, Bill. Anything you can do to get the antenna outside the car is going to help. I used to think that the only way to get a mag mount outside of a car would be to bring the cable in through the window or to close the door on the cable. And on a couple of occasions, that allowed the water to pour down the cable and pour into my car on a rainy day. And I soon discovered that if you're smart enough, a modern-day mag mount has got a nice piece of plastic on the bottom so it doesn't put any scratches on the sheet metal of the car. And if you're smart enough, there's ways of dressing the cable so that it enters the lip of the door but does not cross the main piece of rubber on the top of the door. And you dress the rubber, you dress the RG58 cable around the perimeter of the door when the door is open, and only cross the rubber of the door down at the bottom where the rain doesn't go. And then the coax cable crosses the rubber seal of the door down at the bottom of the door, goes inside the car, goes under the mat. You may have to use some tape to hold it in the right position. And then you can close the door on it. A person getting into the rear door of a four-door car will not be encountering that cable at the transmission line. You have the mag mount on the roof, hopefully a 5/8 wave, but quarter wave would do. Let me drop. And then the cable crosses the rubber seal at the bottom of the door, immediately goes under the mat in the back of the car, and then crosses over to wherever the rig is. So you could have a very non-intrusive mag mount on somebody else's car, and as long as you're not... As long as you're sure you've got a good piece of plastic on the bottom of its mag mount, it will not scratch the paint on the car, will not create any damage, and you'll get 10 or 15 decibels stronger signal to every Peter you want to talk to with that mag mount on the roof of the car, outside the car. Any antenna you put inside the car will sort of work. And will it work better than the rubber duck is a darn interesting question. Not by a whole lot. KC2SYL, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. And Bill, I do have that other device, too, that when it attaches to the lip, maybe I'll bring both of them to try that. I'm not too sure about the mag mat and the cable to Toyota, so I'm a little concerned if we're going to run wires under the floor mat based on the discussions we had about Toyotas a couple of weeks ago. One other question about antennas, and then... the difference between long wire and open wire. I've been reading up on them, and I would just like to know the difference. I think I know the difference. Long wire is a ladder line, and open wire is ladder line, and long wire is just a plain wire. But I'm just trying to get the terminology. I'm trying to increase my knowledge of antennas here. And back to that.
With the mag mount on the roof of the car, where the radiation is using that beautiful steel on the roof as its counterpoise, and that radiating structure is so far away from the instrument panel, the emission control computer, and the motor under the hood. It's so far away from it that until you run numbers like 200 watts or more, I would not worry about disturbing the computer in your Toyota automobile. And even if you're not running any RF equipment in your Toyota automobile, everybody within the sound of my voice must learn to teach your wife, your friends, anybody you know who owns a Toyota automobile, that although it's a low probability, If it happens, if the car goes into the stuck throttle, wide open mode, plan ahead of time. We'll put that transmission into neutral. End or turn off the key. Don't do one of those two operations. It is game over. Your chances of surviving are rather poor. And in the case of some of these keyless start engines where you press a start button to start the engine and you don't have a key, know ahead of time that when you press that start button and hold it down for 3 seconds, it turns off the engine. So if you do run into a stuck throttle mode, you will put it into neutral and or you will turn off the key in order to save your life. And as I said, it's a low probability, but if it happens, because the situation is so serious, let me drop. Because the situation is so serious, 4 million Toyota, Lexus, one other brand name, I can't remember it right now, automobiles, are going to be recalled within the next 6 months. 4 million automobiles to correct this potential problem. And whether or not it's caused by a stuck floor mat is controversial. Because the actual throttle is a fly-by-wire system. There's an electronic command that goes from the throttle. It's not a mechanical leakage anymore. And if that electronic command going to the computer, which then moves a servo mechanism motor on the butterfly of the carburetor, and that in turn has a potentiometer which feeds back the position of that butterfly. If that potentiometer at the carburetor fails, if the potentiometer at the gas pedal fails, if the electronic command between the two fails, if the computer program goes into a hang-up mode, if there's an electronic glitch anywhere in that system, in some rare occasion, the engine goes flat out, and your car will rapidly be up to 120 miles an hour, and you'll be saying some awful strong, salty language real fast. Got a plan ahead of time. You're going to put the car in neutral. Who cares if the engine races? You're saving your life. And the engine does have a rev limiter on its computer. And or turn off the key. You just try to jam your foot down on the brakes. Most of the time, it will not do what you desire. Okay, so that problem you have to plan on ahead of time. But where you're not running hundreds of watts, a mag mount in a Toyota automobile, which is exactly what I'm running, stop worrying. That's what I say, Bill. Now, one last question. Let me drop. A open wire fed antenna usually is used for feeding the center of an antenna, like a dipole. And maybe you're using the dipole on multiple bands. Because the open wire is so low in loss, and if you've got an antenna tuner that's wide enough in tuning characteristics, you can make that run on every single band, usually. But whether it's an open wire or any other feeding method of a so-called random length wire antenna, where you're feeding one end, an end-fed ZEP antenna, I strongly recommend that you try to make the length of the wire an even number of quarter wavelengths long. A number of half wavelengths long. Because when you make it a number of half wavelengths long, and you're feeding it from one end, the impedance you see at the antenna is 1,500, 2,000 ohms, and under those conditions, and only under those conditions, what you do with the shield of the cable, or the other wire of the open wire cable, no longer matters. You can let it hang in the air. It works like a charm. That's how the Zeppelin antenna worked. In some cases, they would ground the shield to the metal frame of the Zeppelin. But as long as the wire is a multiple of a half wavelength in length, giving you a high impedance, feeding it with one wire works very well. If it is a odd number of quarter wavelengths long, where the impedance of what you feed is very low, you can still do it with coax or open wire line, but you're now going to be feeding current back down onto that transmission line. The transmission line is going to become part of the radiator, and you will, in many cases, have RF in the shack. So it's a less desirable situation. I'm not saying it stops working. It's just less desirable. Does some of that make some sense, Bill? And I've got to move on. KC2SYL, K2RIW.
Yes, it does. The question I had, the difference between long wire and open wire. When I looked at open wire in the antenna book, it seemed to indicate it was just lateral line only. I just wanted clarification on that. And thanks for everything. And if you want to open a discussion on the Toyota situation, I did perform a static test. If you want me to share that with you, I will.
How many watts did you transmit into what kind of an antenna, located where, with your Toyota, and what did you observe? That is a darn hot subject. Can give that to us, Bill. Go ahead.
No, I didn't transmit either in a Toyota yet, but I did perform a static test in a Toyota, not under speed, but just sitting in a driver's seat, and I'd like to share that with you if you can open the discussion.
Yeah, sitting in the driver's seat, what did you do and what did you observe, Bill? Go ahead.
Okay, I was in the driver's seat in my driveway, turned on the ignition, and in the Toyota especially, I'm not sure about other foreign cars, but the shift lever is in the center of the console, and there are two positions. You put it in drive, and then there's a position where you can lock it. I think it's designed so you don't inadvertently hit the shift lever with your elbow. So in order to go to neutral, now I did a static test. I started the car in neutral, obviously, in the driveway, put two hands on a steering wheel, and then in my mind I said the car accelerated uncontrollably. So it's a multi-step process. You step on a brake, nothing happens. Then you have to go, something has to go through your mind. What's the next step? In order to get out of the lock position and to go into neutral, it's actually a two-step process. You have to move the shift lever to the right, maybe a quarter of an inch, into the position where it can go into neutral. Then you can put it in neutral. And then you have to manually turn off the key. So it's a multi-step process. So I can see where if someone is driving in it and they have a lot of fear, it's going to be kind of tough to coordinate all that. And there's also the possibility of the arc of how your arm goes. You can really get your arm all tangled up there, I think. So I was reluctant to go to a place where I could actually do it under speed because I don't have a place where I could accelerate to 40, 50 miles an hour safely. Thank you.
Wow. What you just described, in my opinion, Bill, is lethal. That is almost exactly what happened to the man in California who was part of the California Highway Patrol, and he had three other members in his car, and all four of them died. Because it was a 2009 Lexus vehicle that was loaned to him because his repair shop was fixing his vehicle, and his members of his family were on the cell phone while the vehicle was going down a California highway at 120 miles an hour, and he was riding the brakes, and it turns out that he burned up the brakes and it didn't even slow down the vehicle a slight bit. And he went over an embankment and the car crashed and everybody died. Because he couldn't find that complicated mechanism to get the vehicle into neutral. As I said, this is a highway patrol officer who does safety inspections of vehicles, familiar with a lot of vehicles, and it also had a keyless start. He didn't know he had to hold the start button down for 3 seconds to kill the motor, and with that complicated shift mechanism to make sure it doesn't shift into neutral by mistake, he, under the heat of battle, under the panic, he could not find how to get that damn vehicle into neutral. Because he couldn't get it into neutral, hadn't practiced that complicated maneuver, and couldn't kill the engine, that's the reason everyone died. What you just described to me is a very lethal setup when you have a runaway throttle. Am I misinterpreting this, Bill? KC2SYL, K2RIW.
K2RIW. No, not at all. I just performed a static test and I ran through my mind what would happen. Two hands on a wheel, anticipating an acceleration of the car going to 30 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour, whatever it is. You know, how would you stop it? And it's a multi-step process. You have to take your right hand off the wheel, move the shift lever out of the lock position, only about a quarter of an inch, and then put it in neutral, and then find the key and turn the key on. So it's going to take maybe maybe a second and a half, but the reaction time, especially if you're trying to control the car with two hands on the steering wheel and pressing on a brake, I can see where that would not everyone would be, you know, have the wherewithal, or not the wherewithal, but wouldn't have the presence of mind to do that. So it's a very complicated situation. I think the test is take it maybe to a parking lot and maybe Jones Beach and accelerate it and see how it works, but there is really no safe place, I think, where you can accelerate 60 miles an hour without, you know, without another passenger or driver in a car or an observer. Back to you.
Very good, Bill. You brought us some valuable information. I now have a little bit more of a story and a little bit more understanding of what that poor guy in California ran into. And, wow. Yeah, this is a beautiful example of where human engineering of a vehicle went awry. I can see how modern-day automobile manufacturers got into what's called fly-by-wire. This is, in other words, purely an electronic signal that goes from the accelerator pedal to the computer and in turn to the engine by way of the butterfly and the fuel injectors and whatever. The reason for that complicated system is because you no longer can tolerate just a simple mechanical linkage between the accelerator and the carburetor. For the reason of, let me drop. We and all the rules that have been set now for vehicles manufactured and sold in the United States are that we want to have the highest possible gas mileage, the lowest possible undesired emissions. In order to make all of that happen, when you command by way of the gas pedal extra acceleration out of that engine, doing about four or five things all at once with just the right ratios, you're opening up the butterfly in the carburetor just the right amount, you're turning on the fuel injectors for just the right amount, you're looking at the oxygen sensor and readjusting things to make sure that the combustion is happening right, the amount of power being generated is right, the timing is right, you're adjusting timing, fuel mixture, air, oxygen sensing, and whatever. That computer is doing a lot of busy work, and a simple mechanical linkage between the gas pedal and the engine cannot do that. So that's why you're talking to a computer, you're not talking to the engine. But heaven help you if that engine has a noisy potentiometer on that butterfly, if the computer gets the wrong message by whatever means, if that wiring goes haywire, if that sending sensor on the accelerator pedal goes crazy, if any one of those things goes into a crazy mode, there is the possibility of that engine going flat out and your life suddenly becomes very complicated real fast. Only defense I know of for this situation, assuming that during the recall they do the right thing. Let me drop. Because the recall is going to affect 4 million vehicles of three brand names, Toyota, Lexus, and Prius, are all going to be recalled. Everything from roughly 2005 on, I'm not sure of the exact year, because they've all got this potential problem. Part of what's going to take place, I hope, is a change in the computer program so that the computer program, emission control computer, recognizes the fact that if the driver pressed on the brake pedal, that command takes priority over everything else. The brake command takes priority, and the engine goes into an idle mode, not flat out. That computer program has got to be changed, and you've got to make sure you've got extremely high reliability on that sensing circuit on the brake pedal. That combined with making sure that the floor mat cannot be shifted and jam against the brake pedal. That combined with education. What made me so damn angry a month or so ago, let me drop, is that on a particular Thursday night, where ABC, NBC, CBS, all of the news programs, PBS, they all told you how bad the situation is. But not one of those programs told you what to do. That's only half the story. You, as a driver, must be educated ahead of time that although it's not a high probability problem, if it happens, this is what you must do. And you did exactly the right thing, Bill, to practice that in your driveway. How are you going to move that complicated shift lever to get that engine into neutral and then to kill the engine if you have to? Neutral first, key off second. And if you when that throttle goes flat out, know ahead of time that the brake pedal probably will not protect you. We have to tell people this. Otherwise, some percentage of 4 million people with those vehicles that are about to be recalled, and they're not going to be recalled for 6 months, their life is going to be at risk. Some of those are ham radio operators. You and I don't want their lives at risk, as well as other people, of course. I'm exaggerating on that one. So I'm a little hot under the collar on this one, the fact that the news media eventually started telling us what to do. But I'm not, each one of the people I know who has just recently bought or owns, let me drop, a Toyota Prius or Lexus automobile, I ask him the question, if the throttle goes flat out, what are you going to do? Two-thirds of the people I talk to have a response that I call deer in the headlights. They have that bright-eyed response, and if they give me a response at all, they say, well, I'm going to hit the brake. To which I say, if the brake does nothing, what are you going to do next? And I haven't, for the most part, gotten a proper answer out of two-thirds of the people who I've talked to. Maybe my friends are not smart enough. Maybe they haven't listened to the right news programs. You have to tell your friends about this. To me, it's a very serious problem. Okay. We've now come to the time in which we're going to be discussing balance. And I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction, and Mel's going to give us the real story. And Mel, anything you can do to slightly increase your power up would help. The signal's a little bit noisy tonight. And if not, don't worry about it. If you don't have the ability to do it. What is the balance? Almost all of the antennas that we usually feed of a dipole-like nature are a balanced antenna. What I mean by that is when you feed the dipole RF energy in the correct manner, it wants to see a thoroughly symmetric signal. What do I mean by a symmetric signal? Assume that I'm feeding the center of my half-wave dipole, doesn't matter what band it's on, and I just happen to be feeding a 2-volt signal out of my transmission line right now. And you and I could easily calculate how many watts is that or how many milliwatts is that. It's less than a watt of power. But I'm putting 2 volts into the dipole. Now, if I'm feeding the dipole correctly, the sine wave of signal that I'm putting into it, at, say, for instance, 3.8 megacycles, and I'm studying the way the sine wave behaves, and I stop time at the instant I'm at the positive peak of the first sine wave that I'm feeding to the antenna. I'm stopping time and analyzing what goes on. At that instant, assume I'm feeding 2 volts from my transmission line into the antenna. If the antenna is being fed correctly, the right-hand side of the dipole is seeing +1 volt with reference to ground. The left side of the dipole is seeing -1 volt with reference to ground. Between the two sides is the 2 volts. That is a thoroughly symmetric way of feeding the dipole. If I now let time flow for a half cycle, and I go to the negative peak of the sine wave that I'm feeding into the antenna, and I stop time again, and I analyze it, now the right-hand side of the dipole is at -1 volt, and the left side of the dipole is at +1 volt, right at the feed point. That's a thoroughly symmetric way of feeding the dipole. That's the way the dipole wants to see the signal arriving to its front door in order for it to behave correctly. You feed the dipole any other way, your life's going to get a little bit more complicated. It's not a showstopper, but it's less than ideal. I'll explain what I mean by that. If I'm using twin lead or open wire line to feed the dipole, and if I'm properly feeding the open wire line in the shack with the right kind of a balancing device, and we're going to get into that in a minute, so that that thoroughly symmetric signal goes up the open wire line or the twin lead, so that at every instant of time, whenever voltage is on the right-hand side of the wire, the left-hand side has the exact same magnitude of the exact opposite polarity. If I'm feeding the wire in a thoroughly symmetric manner and it's connected to that dipole, everything's hunky-dory. However, 90% of us just love coaxial cable. Coaxial cable is not a balanced feeding line. Properly used, a coax cable has, you could say, all of the signal is on the semiconductor, and as far as the outside shield is concerned, none of the signal is on the outside shield. Well, a better scientist investigating with his X-ray vision what's going on inside the coax cable knows that there is a signal between semiconductor of the coax cable and the inner surface of the outer shield. And there is no RF energy on the outside surface of the outer shield, the outer braid. That's if the coax cable is being used correctly. And for simplicity reasons, I'd love to bring that coax cable up to the center of my dipole and take the center conductor, connect it to the right-hand side of the dipole, connect the shield, connect it to the left side of the dipole. The dipole wants to see a symmetric signal, but my coax cable is giving it an unsymmetric signal. And that dipole, you think it's got a 70 ohm impedance across its feed terminals. That's an overly simplistic problem, analysis. In reality, the dipole has a 35 ohm impedance from the right side to ground, and it's got 35 ohms from the left side to ground, and those two impedances are in series with each other. Yes, you'll see roughly 70 ohms in the center, but it really is two separate impedances to ground. You're going to say, what do you mean by ground? I mean, that dipole might be out in free space. That dipole might be held in the hands of an astronaut. This is a UHF dipole, and he's floating out in front of the space shuttle with his space suit on. He's really in free space. You're going to say to me, where the heck is ground in that situation? RF-wise, there still is a ground. If you don't want RF in If you don't want RF energy flowing down that transmission line, even that dipole in truly free space, and I mean really in outer space, you still are going to feed it in a symmetric manner. If you don't, the dipole with its 35 ohms to what it thinks is ground, somewhere in the universe it thinks there's a ground there, it is a 35 impedance, right side to ground, left side to ground, you feed it with a coax cable, you will, even in that free space environment, end up with RF energy flowing back down the outside of the coax cable. Now you're going to have RF in the shack, and the cable is going to be part of your radiating system. Only by placing the right kind of a balancing device at the output end of the coax, at the input end of the dipole, are you going to avoid that situation. There's a whole lot of solutions to this. There's a lot more to the story, and I shouldn't be taking the wind out of Mel's sail, because he's got a whole prepared package on this. And go ahead, Mel, K2KEY, and try not to forget about the 90-second timer like I do, K2LIW. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY, basically. This is exactly what I was just going to cover with the coax cable. All right, well, to be redundant, I guess I'll sort of give my little spiel here. Said to everybody, you know, if you want to follow along, get a piece of paper, and I was going to give you a little diagram to make. So, if you want to do it, take the piece of paper and make three vertical lines on a piece of paper about an inch apart. Three vertical lines, each one an inch apart from the other. And after you do that, I want you to, at the top of the center line of this vertical line, make a line to the left, a horizontal line to the left, any length. And I want you also to connect the two outer lines, the two outer vertical lines together on both the bottom and the top. Any questions so far in this?
When I connect the two vertical lines, the outer lines together on the top and the bottom, am I sort of drawing a rectangle with that vertical inverted L in the middle of it? Mel, go ahead.
Roger. We're actually representing a piece of coax in large size. And up at the top where you connected the two outer lines together, put another horizontal line off that. Now, the line that's on the left, up from the center, that goes left, the horizontal line, mark that I1 plus I2 with an arrow pointing to the right. That's the top left line. You're going to put a little arrow pointing to the right, mark that I1 plus I2, The wire that's on the right side that's connected to the two that we threw out of a vertical line, off that I-1 and an arrow also going to the right. Any questions?
Okay. There's a second wire above the top horizontal one. I presume that lies parallel. I'm not sure about that one yet. The center vertical line had a line going over to the left on the top of it. I think that became an arrow aimed to the right, labeled I-1 plus I-2. The right-hand vertical line, you said to add an arrow to the right, labeled I-1. And I guess I really would like to know, on the most right-hand vertical line, that horizontal arrow going over to the right, do I connect it at the top, middle, or bottom of that right-hand vertical line with the I-1 on it? Over to you, Mel.
Now you're going to connect that to the two wires, the two outer wires. In other words, we're actually drawing us like a picture of a piece of coax cable. You can actually look at it as cylindrical, the two outer wires, the outer portion of the cylinder, and the center wire, the center part of your coax. In other words, we're looking at an enlarged view or a picture of what a dipole will look like, Dick, over.
Okay. I've got a outer rectangle that goes from the top of the outer vertical line and the bottom of the outer vertical line. I've got another horizontal wire connecting them. So I'm looking at a rectangle that is wider from left to right and not as wide top to bottom. Am I looking at a piece of coax in the Z direction down the center of the coax, or am I looking at a piece of coax cable side view? That I don't know yet. And the I-1 plus I-2 arrow, I guess it's just labeling the fact that that center vertical line represents the center conductor, and that's the current on it. And the right-hand vertical line has I-1. I think you're telling me that's the shield, and the arrow is pointing toward that shield, telling me I-1 is flowing on it. Is that roughly it there, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger. And on the right side, we're putting another horizontal line representing the other half of the dipole. And on the right horizontal line, we're going to mark that I-1 with an arrow going also to the right. In other words, this represents a piece of coax cable. If we were actually peering into it, the two outer lines being the shield, the center being the center conductor. Now, on the center conductor, in the middle of this rectangle, I'm going to put an arrow going down. Mark that I-1 plus I-2 and an arrow facing downward on that vertical line. In the middle, on the middle of the three lines. In other words, I-1, I plus I-2, the arrow going down, representing going down the coax stick. Over.
Okay, so that center vertical line represents the center conductor of the coax cable. And this whole diagram I'm drawing is I'm looking at the coax cable with X-ray vision, as if I have sliced it open the long way, where I've sliced away half the coax cable. Is that approximately true? Mel, go ahead.
Roger, exactly. Now, on the outer shield, or on the outside line, let's say the one on the right of the three vertical lines, or the right side of the coax cable, the piece cable going up, you can mark that with an arrow pointing upward. Mark that I-1 plus I-2 on that piece of cable. So this represents basically the two components, I-1 and I-2. And also, theoretically, we're looking at the center conductor and the outside braid. In other words, if you, like you say, split open a piece of, we bisected a piece of coax cable that was hooked to an dipole, Dick. Over.
Okay, I think I'm beginning to see it. So the shield of the coax cable, the outer vertical lines, go to the piece of dipole that goes off to the right. The semiconductor of the coax cable goes to the half of the dipole that goes off to the left. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. That's it. So we're looking at now a piece of coax cable hooked directly to the dipole. Now, if, however, let's see now, how can I more give it? I think that's a pretty good explanation. Of course, the bottom of this would be hooking to your rig. The center line would actually be going to the center connection of the rig, and the outer portion, the shield, of course, would be going to the ground. So, you see what's happening here. It actually, what we call now, when this is the imbalanced, unbalanced mode. And if everything was, you know, really balanced here, when we look for it, we're using open wire feeding, you would see that we could avoid a problem here. The problem here, you'll notice, if you look at the arrows, the I1s and the I2s, how it's coming down, it actually is causing what we call an inverted L effect. In other words, two dipole elements are becoming part of the coax. And this is basically what you are seeing when you are operating a dipole without a phallum. This is basically what I'm trying to illustrate, Dick, over.
One of the questions some of the listeners might have, Mel, is what is I1, what is I2? Are those the currents flowing on each half of the dipole? Or is one of them forward current, one of them reverse current? They might want to know what is I1, what is I2? Go ahead.
Hey, I1 and I2 are the two currents, two equal and opposite transmission line currents that occur on the coax cable in this case. Take over.
Okay, but what is the origin of I1? What is the origin of I2? Go ahead.
Okay, well, the coax at the bottom is hooked to the rig, the generator, the amplifier, whatever you want to call it. And this is to illustrate the various currents at the feed points of a dipole. Being I1 is the dipole current, and I2 would be the inverted L, or imbalanced current, that will occur, Dick, over.
Okay. Is it possible that one of those I1s or I2s could be called differential mode current, and one of them could be called common mode current? And I know we're going to have to explain that if that happens to be accurate. But at first, is that what they possibly are, and then we got to explain it? Over to you, Mel.
Right, cool. And what's the inverted L?
Hey, hold on a minute, please. Let's not get too far ahead, because then I'm going to get a lot of questions that we lost you. Actually, what we're looking at now is the balanced antenna if this antenna had, okay, let me make it a little bit simpler. Theoretically, a balanced antenna with a balanced feed, instead of using coax, we would actually have a ground or zero potential plane bisecting the spacing. However, since we're using a coax feed, which is unbalanced, and the outer braid is also connected to the ground at some point in the system, an imbalance exists at the feed point, and it gives rise to two antenna modes, basically. One is I1, giving a dipole mode, and the other is the I2, giving the antenna an inverted L mode. This is basically what I'm trying to illustrate, Dick. Over.
Okay, I think I see it. Let's see if Paul's got it. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
not sure of the definition of the inverted L mode, if that's what I'm getting at.
Looks like Paul needs some further explanation of what you're really saying when you talk about the inverted L mode. Is that the semiconductor of the coax cable, which is the center vertical line in the diagram, going up and hitting the left-hand side of the dipole, which goes over to the left, so that becomes an upside-down L. So the left-hand side of the dipole combined with the center conductor of the cable that it's connected to. Is that the inverted L you're referring to, Mel? Go ahead.
Gotcha. In other words, if you look, like you say, from the left, that horizontal wire, that horizontal part of the dipole, coming back down through the coax. So if you look at it, it looks like an inverted L. That's how they get the term inverted L. The inverted L mode, inverted L antennas, and the same thing is occurring with the one to the right. It's the braid of the antenna. The braid of the coax is becoming also an inverted L-type situation. So this is what is taking place on your dipole when you're not using a balun or balun. So the what happens, I was going to continue on now, what happens to the real effect on the antenna itself, but does everyone understand this inverted L that I just was explaining over?
So I think the center conductor plus the left-hand side of the dipole is an upside-down L going to the left. The shield of the coax cable plus the right-hand side of the dipole is an inverted L going to the right. So I think we're now seeing the way that that coax cable is feeding the two halves of that dipole. Have I got it approximately correct, Mel? Go ahead. And when you pick up the transmitter, wait 1 second before you start talking. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is me. Without a balun, all L will break loose.
That's one way of putting it. You got it, Mel.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yes, you can. Make a quick comment.
Mel, on Sunday at 11 o'clock, is that 28.380? Is that 11 o'clock a.m.?
I think Eugene asked me what about the 10-meter net. Yes, 28.380, 11 a.m. in the morning, Eugene.
Okay, that's on Sunday, right? I didn't hear nothing at all. Okay, I'll play next Sunday again. Okay, let's be sure I go, let's be sure all clear.
Hey, Eugene. Yeah, we were on this morning, had about 10 people check in, as usual, New Jersey, Staten Island, all around the metropolitan area. We always have check-ins, Eugene. 28.380, 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. Okay, so where were we? Yes, so actually we're looking at two inverted L's. So, now, taking steps to minimize this, this is what I was trying to get at. To minimize this, you have to eliminate or minimize the undesirable inverted L. And then I'll talk about some experiments that were done with this effect. We want to eliminate this or minimize the I2 situation. So the obvious thing is a well-designed balun, which not only provides that balanced feed, but also minimize in a choking type of reactant. That's what it is. It's called a choking reactant, basically, and it will try to minimize that I2 that exists. Now, however, there is another ways to discourage this inverted L mode, and that is to bring the coax cable perpendicular off the dipole, and then I'll tell you about an experiment. Everybody understand so far what I'm talking about? Over.
If I take your three vertical lines and make them taller, I'm really extending the length of the coax cable. And as I see it right now, since the right-hand side of the dipole goes over to the right-hand side of the page, so to speak, the left-hand side of the dipole goes towards the left side of the page, the two horizontal portions of the dipole are parallel to the base of my piece of paper, the bottom of the page. Right now, that transmission line appears on my diagram to be coming away from the dipole at right angles to the dipole. So, do I have my diagram correct, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger, you have it right. And so here we are with this situation, and we're getting an inverted L type of condition. And this is, in fact, encouraged. This inverted L condition that we're getting is encouraged, especially if the coax cable is not perpendicular to the dipole. There are a number of steps that I was alluding to control this, and one step, in fact, is to ground the coaxial cable at the quarter wave or multiple thereof from the feed point. This will encourage this inverted L mode, since it wants to see high impedance at these lengths instead of the low impedance of the ground connection. And there is a number of things that is applied to this, and some experiments, very interesting experiments that can be done with inverted L mode that makes it not so bad after all, Dick. Over.
If I did take the right-hand side of the dipole a quarter a wave from where it's being fed and grounded it, because it's a kind of a transmission line, and because transmission line inverts impedance every quarter wave, the short circuit on the right-hand side to ground becomes an open circuit at the point it's being fed, and the same with the left-hand side. The net result is now I'm going to have a impedance at the center of the dipole that is close to infinity, if I neglect the energy that flows down the dipole that is radiated in space. So those two short circuits are going to present a center impedance close to infinity. My coax cable, seeing that infinity as a load, is going to be fairly unhappy. So if I did that, I don't think I've got a good system yet, unless I've misunderstood. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, right. Basically, you're not having a great system. So what happened was there was an experiment, a very interesting experiment to do, with just setting up the dipole as it was, and in fact, Jerry Civic wrote extensively on it, you know, the why of a Balaam. And he went ahead and he set this up just the way it was. He put up a 20-meter half-wave dipole, and he gave he cut it to resonance with the 50-ohm cable, and he compared the VSWR under different conditions. When the coax cable was in the ground plane of the antenna, in other words, perpendicular to the axis of the antenna, the VSWR curve
was
pretty good. But very close, in fact, to what he found, the same thing as when he added a Balaam. And so he then started moving the coax cable. Now, this is now without the Balaam, or the Balaam. He started moving the coax cable, and he found, like, for instance, when you get 45 degrees under the dipole, that he saw a change in the VSWR. And this meant that he was getting this inverted L mode situation showing up more pronounced. Over.
And the Jerry Civic that Mel is referring to is W2FMI, Fox Mike India, a man who wrote a lot of articles about Balin. And by the way, Balin is spelled B-A-L-U-N, or in some books it's B-A-L-U-U-N. I'll give you that phonetically. B-A-L-U-N, Baker, Lima, Uniform, November. It is a contraction of two words. The two words are balanced and unbalanced. It's a contraction of the first syllable of the two words, balanced and unbalanced. And that's what the balun, that's the way I pronounce it. Not everyone pronounces it the same way. That's the way I envision what it does. It's a converting device between the unbalanced coax cable and the really balanced dipole when the dipole is used in the ordinary manner, center-fed. So, and so Jerry wrote some very nice articles about the 10 or 15 kinds of balance. There's lots of kinds of balance, depending on whether you want current, voltage, step-up impedance, step-down impedance, and so on. So that's some of what Mel is referring to. And let me drop for a second. And I think you're saying that Jerry Civic, W2FMI, a guy from Bell Laboratories, real smart guy, and as I said, he became a silent key not too long ago. We're going to miss him. He discovered that when you take the coax cable and don't bring it or the transmission line, if the transmission line feeding the dipole is not directly at right angles to the dipole, as you start bending it and folding it more and more parallel to the dipole, the radiation from the dipole starts coupling energy into the transmission line. You start getting a reaction between the two, an interaction between the two, and Jerry sensed a change in standing wave ratio in the shack when he did that. That's what I think Mel just said, and I'm trying to reword it in my words. And Mel, did I get it right or get it wrong? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. That's exactly the experiment. He wants to know, do you need a balun? Because I guess he got a number of questions from people. And he showed. In fact, a lot of the people mentioned, they said, well, even with the balun, I notice when the wind blows, my SWR changes. The VSWR changes. And he explained that they are getting basically still somewhat of an effect on an inverted L mode. And that was the reason he showed that the number of the so-called, many sometimes these balums that are bogging or incorrectly applied, there is an indication that this L mode effect is still apparent on their dipole. So, taking that into consideration, there was basically the reason for trying to eliminate or minimize the cell mode. However, there was another gentleman, and he did a very interesting experiment. First of all, let's first say that this so-called L mode or inverted L situation, or in some cases they'll refer to it as a rate current, it really does confuse SWR measurements. And that's what causes a lot of hams to start changing the lines and tuning the lines and changing, you know, the length of the of the dipole to see if they can fix this up. Whereas that is the problem, that you're getting this so-called L mode, inverted L effect, tick over.
Okay, so that's his way of explaining some of the undesired currents flowing on the cable, interaction between the transmission line and the antenna, creating standing wave ratio changes that he sensed in the shack. He calls it the L antenna mode. I would call it balanced to unbalanced mode. You can give it lots of words. And I think I'm waiting to see what some other solutions to this are going to be. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. So he showed that his application of putting the vellum on there minimizes or